Did the media cover your station at all?
It seemed to be that there was a lot of listeners. In my own experiences, while I was on the air, I've actually received a good number of phone calls, probably about 7 or 8 from listeners, just during my first 2 or 3 shows. There was quite a bit of media attention on Radio Mutiny. As I said, they were a burgeoning station, and they were coming out as a national leader in the effort to re-legalize community-based radio and under 100 watts. So, like, there's a couple newspapers, like weekly papers there. One was called the City Paper, and that was actually an independent paper, but they did sell advertising. But they covered the station quite a few times. We got the cover issue in April, shortly after the conference and after the Liberty Bell protest, in which the condom lady was depicted nude on the cover of the City Paper. Actually, she did do that the night after the the night after the Liberty Bell protest. She went on the air naked in the fears that the FCC would come, and her idea was that if she was naked, they would have to, like, go away or try and find a woman to drag her out, or at least bring a towel. So it was more of a trying to keep them away.
Also kind of a publicity stunt, which, yeah. If the FCC knows she's naked, that they might be fearing media covering it more than kind of a hook for that to happen. Now, let me see if I understood. Was the station eventually either intimidated into closing or closed through FCC pressure or actual raid?
Some of the programmers were intimidated off the air, but not the hardcore members like myself. But the station eventually was closed down shortly after the Dunafer decision came down in June, and in which Claudia Wilkin ruled in favor of the FCC's injunction to cease, in joining Free Radio Berkeley with others acting in concert. That was the word in the wording in the brief there. But shortly after that, they got the warrant signed by a judge in the Philadelphia Circuit Court. And, yeah, they served their warrant on the 22nd of June at 6:30 p.m., which happened to be a Monday, which was my allotted time slot. Now, I had received warning that there was a possibility that they would raid that night, and I chose to evade getting busted, so to speak. And my idea was that if I didn't show up to my show at 6 p.m., then they couldn't really serve their warrant. I had falsely assumed that you had to be in the act of broadcasting to actually be seized like that, when in fact we were not on the air. The station was shut down at the time of the raid, and they busted in the door. There was 3 FCC agents, including Richard Lee, Chief of Compliance and Information.
Did he have on his Borg outfit at the same time his resistance, his feudal shtick?
Actually, he was in a suit and tie, from what I was told, and they were accompanied by 3...
His Borg outfit, yeah.
Yes, his Borg dress. They were accompanied by 3 uniformed United States Marshals who were armed, and they served their warrant while nobody was there. This is the interesting part, and to my knowledge, has never been done by FCC. They went to the station, got in, and actually turned on the transmitter to make an announcement that this station operating on 91.3 FM has been broadcasting without a license and is now officially being seized, so to speak. And they actually made that announcement over the airwaves and officially became pirates themselves.
Yeah, you know, it sounds like this guy Lee is just in typical kind of abusive authority fashion, using public power and police power to kind of engage in his own ego fantasy. So one day he's debating you, you know, maybe in his own mind, in the lion's den with his micro-broadcasting pirate opponents, and the next day he's smashing down your door and making little comments on your station. It's sort of like he finds it an amusing episode. And in a way, I guess you can see it that way, and I guess it's better to laugh than to go bananas or cry, maybe not. But it seems to me that this kind of antics on public trough, I might add, the public is paying this clown's salary to sort of essentially snicker at and wee-wee on the First Amendment is a sort of his personal role-playing game is really outrageous. I mean, it's really outrageous because Philadelphia and every other city in this country deserves the right to have this the kind of radio station that you were using, you were broadcasting on. I've heard your shows. I like my shows. I like the show I just heard, that I guess it was a tape that was playing all night about you're not likely to hear on any of the mainstream stations about people in Haiti making shirts that they sell here for $20 and they get 3 cents off that shirt. An incredible reality that I was never aware of till I heard that tape. I don't know how many folks are aware of that kind of exploitation. That kind of news doesn't get out in the daily papers and the daily stations. And I'm telling most of our listeners what they know already, but it's kind of fun and it's nice that the FCC can, you know, clown around a bit. But it's not really clowning around when people are kept from getting out very important information that may save lives, where we're talking about needle exchange or cannabis use or exposing police abuse and bad cops. That's not being done because this guy is having a fun time closing down stations and cavorting around in the great stage of his own mind. What do you think?
I think you're absolutely right. You know, it's a matter of saving lives, especially in Philadelphia, because that was a lot of their programming was concerned with. And yes, there was some of the more fun shows that just play music and don't really talk much about issues, but that goes along with it. You know, that's all part of free speech. And the reality is that Philadelphia is a very economically depressed area, and the fact is that there's not much information on the airwaves in Philly. And I was appalled just tuning in to some of the stations that you hear the same thing over and over again. And any time that they do talk about issues like the death penalty or homelessness, it's always from a different slant. You don't get the real issues out there. It's always like the same, like you hear on KSCO, the same banter from the same conservative right-wing idiots that are allowed to use the airwaves. And that's, you know, why I was really happy to be a part of Radio Mutiny, because it was about something different. It was about a different opinion, much like we are here.
Well, let's hope that a mutiny has another mutiny and goes on the air again, although it becomes difficult. And we're going to talk to you about that. But first, we're going to take a musical break. And then I'm going to read an article on micro-broadcasting from Z Magazine, which some of you may have already read, but I think is of interest. And then I'm going to ask Vinny more questions about the differences between what's happening in Philadelphia and what he sees now that he's come back here to Santa Cruz, not just on the radio scene, which I'm interested in, but also as a street activist and Cop Watch reporter. Vinny is the man who gave us the original Happy John Dine tapes, for those of you who may not remember. The tapes made within 10 minutes of Happy John Dine's fatal shooting by Officer Connor Carey were made because Vinny rushed to the scene and began interviewing witnesses. Without those tapes, we would be a lot less far along on that investigation. We would know very little. We would know essentially what reporters for the Santa Cruz Sentinel and cover-up artists from the Citizens Police Review Board and the DA's office have told us. So let's listen to a little music and then get back to Vinny and micro-broadcasting.
Lady, what do you do all day? Lady, how do you spend your time? Lady,
got no time to be standing here gabbling, got no time to be answering. Beds need making, the dishes need washing, and venting need dusting and polishing. Scrubbing and sweeping and sewing and cleaning and cooking and ironing. Are you listening? I'm a production line all by myself, only the wages are missing. Three kids of eight and seven and two, leisure is just a mythology. When it's over my head, I can't put a bed, it's temporal psychology. Mary's bedwetting and Tommy is jealous, the baby is yelling, it's driving me crazy. I'm nursing a nanny until I'm a granny, but why is it nobody pays me? I care for a lovely old mother-in-law, she's 87 and cranky. Husband's home with a feverish cold, run for the tea and the hankies, the hot water bottle, a telly, the paper, and now the kids have it, it must be contagious. So now I'm the family medical staff, but where the hell are my wages? If wives and mothers all took to their heels, you'd soon be needing an army, and paying them all their union wages of that it would drive you barmy. All eyes and ears, hands and feet, my sign is Gemini. Should have been true of me. I'm to the worth of a dozen a day, but where are the wages due to me? Price is so high, wages so low, budgeting must be meticulous. The hours I spend in looking for bargains are crooked and it's really ridiculous. And though my man's doing all that he can, what he brings home is making us weep. Now I have to pay him for a wage himself if the family's going to keep eating. On the table, beds need making, the dishes need washing, it's everything done on the double. Drop the kids off at the school and run from their bus. Don't you think it's outrageous? I've more than enough with my labor of love, now I'm doing another for wages. The boss is as good as a boss can be, but the office is just like a nursery. Smoothing his life, soothing his trouble, remembering his anniversary. Remind and worry and hurry and scurry and into the frying pan, out of the cage, and it's home from home wherever I roam. But at least I'm getting my wages. On my way home, I shop for the dinner and then have a tidy around. Billy comes in, sits down with the paper, says, girl, don't you ever sit down. Men of the world, would you think it was strange, think it was right, think it was funny to slog every night at a job for free after slogging all day for your money? Underpaid, home piecework when she can. perfect lever for the boss against her man. And for a true born woman, that's hard to understand. All her life we nurture, we mothers and the men, that sweet mysterious nature, the cow, the mouse, the hen. Diligent in heart and hand, lazy in her mind, and not till every true-born woman sees this as a crime, and every true-born human leave the past behind. Wages, give me my due, I'm opting out of the system. Give me bonuses, overtime, sick leave, and paid holidays and a pension. Then I can strike, work to rule, or go slow, or object to conditions and hours for wages. Will give me the power to have a say in a word where a person who happens to be female is supposed to be happy to spend all her time as a baby-minded, soft-minded, vacant, quiet, destroyer, frosty, but light sleeper, grass, and the men learn. Nappy folder, hand holder, onion chopper, mess mopper, button sewer, doer, thrower, tidy up, a pencil supper, money stretcher, run and fetcher. Cake maker, bag maker, early waker, bed maker, breakfast maker, lunch maker, tea maker, sandwich maker.
Lady, what do you do all day? Lady, it's your only life. When they ask you, what do you say?
Oh, I don't work, I'm nothing but a housewife.
And that was Peggy Seeger, What Do You Do All Day, from her album Different, Therefore Equal. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, and you're listening to Bathrobe Spears' Broadside, Civil Rights for the Poor show that we have twice a week, 2.5 hours on Sunday, 2 hours on Thursday. That's at 6 o'clock on Thursday and 11 o'clock on Sundays. We're talking, or have been talking, to Vinny, a radio broadcaster here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, a really strong central part of the collective, who recently went back to Philadelphia, and he was telling me about that. And he's going to talk a bit about plans to revivify the radio station, to bring it back to life, and also about what's happening in Philadelphia around anti-homeless laws, and what's happening to him in Santa Cruz, and how he's facing, well, how he sees the city now that he's back, and how the police are greeting his return. But before we get into that, I wanted to read from you an article by Kate Duncan, Micro Broadcasting. Apparently there's even a pirate radio section in Z Magazine, or maybe it's just a one-time article. This is in the July-August 1998 issue of Z. That's the name of the magazine. The movement for low-power community radio was relatively low-key until Stephen Dunifer founded Free Radio Berkeley with the intent not just to operate a small radio station, but to go to court in its defense. While the case lingered in the Ninth Federal District Court, Dunifer used the protection of microbroadcasting's legal limbo to manufacture and distribute transmitters to fledgling stations, most of which broadcast between 10 and 30 watts and have a 2 to 5 mile range. This spring, around 1,000 pirate radio stations, from the clandestine underground to the outspoken demonstrators, discovered each other for the first time at two micro-broadcasting conferences, one in Philadelphia, April 3rd through 5th, and you heard about that one from Vinny here, the other coinciding with the National Association of Broadcasters Convention in Las Vegas the following weekend. Until now, the micro-broadcasting movement's strategy has grown organically without conferences or formal roundtable discussions. Rather, they have used exponential growth, mass media exposure, and stubborn noncompliance with FCC cease-and-desist broadcasting letters. Pirates also adhere to the safety in numbers rule, helping to establish and keep other stations on the air. So far, these strategies have worked. Even USA Today, the New York Times, Time Magazine, and National Pirate Public Radio have picked up the pirate radio station and given it an underdog David and Goliath spin. Pete Tradish of Radio Mutiny, that's of course Vinny's radio station, credits the movement's media presence for embarrassing the FCC into publicly admitting that radio pirates have a point. In a recent Radio World interview, FCC Chair William Kennard stated that they have a legitimate issue and that there are, in some communities, no outlets for expression on the airwaves, and I believe that is a function, in part, of the massive consolidation that we are seeing in the broadcast industry. He stated he was receptive to hearing about models for legal micro-broadcasting. The FCC's new attitude prompted the agency's Chief of Compliance and Information, Richard Lee, that's the man we're talking about, who busted down the door of Radio Mutiny, to request an invitation to speak at the East Coast Microbroadcasting Conference. If you are still looking for someone to moderate the panel called The Bust, What to Do When the FCC Knocks, I would, as a public service, volunteer. So read Lee's surprise email to Radio Mutiny. The message produced mixed feelings in the conference committee. Though some were dubious of Lee's intentions, others were pleased that the FCC had finally recognized him as a force to be reckoned with. After some discussion about whether he belonged within 20 miles of the conference, Radio Mutiny gave Lee a place on Friday's opening panel, but declared the remainder of the conference off-limits. He was joined on the panel by Radio Mutiny's ACLU counsel, Stephen Presser, and two pirate DJs to argue the technical feasibility and democratic necessity of low-watt stations. Though he joked around with a few pirates after his speech and even presented Radio Mutiny with a figurine of a Star Trek character who is forever battling the Borg, Lee remained hard-line in his policy to seek and destroy unlicensed stations. He concluded, "We invite the unlicensed broadcasters and other interested parties to give us their ideas and to work with the FCC in crafting lawful solutions that can result in more local radio outlets for more people in more communities instead of continuing to violate the statute. The FCC will not condone illegal broadcasting, and we will aggressively enforce the law." Since the conference, FCC agents have paid two visits to Radio Mutiny without a warrant and are averaging two busts a week nationally. And of course, since this article was written, Radio Mutiny has been busted. Now that the FCC is willing to talk, the micro-broadcasting movement is taking a turn. The FCC has suffered at our hands up to this point because they refuse to be reasonable, says Pete Tradish. Hence, the sympathetic public and press. But continues Tradish, a likely scenario is that in the next few months, the FCC will offer something that the press thinks looks okay, but will be grossly inadequate and bureaucratic. Some in our movement may grovel for the scraps and start going through the legalization process, and will ultimately get little or nothing out of it. If this scenario plays out, radio pirates whose neighborhoods expand beyond a city block or two will continue to broadcast in spite of the new regulations, but their constitutional argument will be harder to justify to reporters, government, citizens, and judges. Programming within each micro-broadcasting station never spans the spectrum of gender, class, ethnicity, language, culture, politics, sexuality, or humanity. But when set against the backdrop of corporate radio, the movement is about radio diversity. Attendees at the East Coast Conference, though abundantly anarchist, range from riot girls to promise keepers, from Black Liberation Radio to Haitian stations, from communists to militia sympathizers, from high school students to grandmothers. Instead of scrapping, they were strategizing. This diversity is a strong point of a movement that is struggling for democracy on the airwaves, although even that aim is contentious. I didn't appreciate the assumptions that we're all here to promote revolution or to fuck the FCC, said a member of the Iowa City Free Radio. Among the outcomes was the creation of a network of women in micro radio. One of the resolutions of a women-only workshop, says moderator Pirate Jenny of Steal This Radio in New York, is to encourage as many women as possible to become conversant with radio technologies. We're forming an interim program among East Coast pirate radio stations whereby women can learn the technology from other women. Another action resulting from the conference was the simultaneous return to the airwaves of three stations that had received FCC warnings. On April 15th, 87X in Tampa, Florida, Radio Free Alston in Alston, Massachusetts, and Steal This Radio threw their transmitter switches back on. Steal This Radio on the same day announced a lawsuit against the FCC for constitutional protection of broadcasting under 100 watts. Other stations want the FCC to establish a low-watt license and have submitted three different petitions. The more conservative petition on the FCC's agenda, rulemaking number RM9208,
asks that one FM and one AM frequency be set aside nationwide for stations with 1 watt and 50 feet antennas maximum. Another petition, rulemaking number RM9242, advocates a license class for a minimum of 1 watt, a maximum of 50, and a maximum antenna height of 150 feet. Such stations, according to the petition, would be secondary to full power stations and would have to vacate their frequency should a full power station expand. The third petition asks that only that AM and FM service be modified to include allowances for temporary 1 watt broadcasting at events. As of May 20th, about 200 comments have been received by the FCC, according to Maureen Puratino of the Office of Public Affairs, with a ratio of 2-1 in favor of some form of licensed microbroadcasting. FCC staff is reviewing the information and will make recommendations to the agency commissioners, who will then either seek further opinions from interested parties or propose regulations and open them up for comments as well. This is where microbroadcasters with a solid platform can have some weight if the FCC continues its attentions. The aims of microbroadcasting's other factions aren't so clear-cut. Some people want general decriminalization of low-power broadcasting. Low-watt radio stations would still be illegal in that they would broadcast without a license, circumventing the expense and paperwork involved in attaining one. And as an aside, I remind listeners as I read this article by microbroadcasting, called Microbroadcasting by Kate Duncan in the July-August issue of Z, that the cost of a license currently is about $100,000. You include papers, engineers, studies, applications, and so forth. If decriminalized, the FCC would leave such stations alone, except in the event of actual interference with licensed stations or airport control towers. Another group of microbroadcasters insists that as a federal body, the FCC has no power over broadcasts that don't cross state lines. Lonnie Cobras, a microbroadcaster in Lutz, Florida, whose station covers a 5 to 6 mile radius, used this as a defense when the FCC took him to court. Cobra's lawyer, Larry McCraft, writes on the internet that Cobras testified during trial that he had studied the FCC laws and concluded that licensing of radio stations applied only to those engaged in transmissions across state lines or out of the country. One motion in the case reads, "Under the U.S. Constitution, Congress possesses power to regulate and control interstate and foreign commerce. However, in 1982, Congress expanded the criminal statute in the FCC laws to encompass those radio transmissions which are purely intrastate. In this motion, we contend that this law is plainly unconstitutional." Cobra's defense failed its first attempt and is currently on appeal. Finally, there is a group that would conserve any energy spent on analog to use for securing a space for community stations on the digital dial, and a group that doesn't care what the law says. Additionally, the debate ranges to whether ownership limits, commercial, non-commercial status, and other important details should be written into the regulations. Those who would disregard the law, no matter what it says, won't have the immediate problem. Regardless of what becomes of the FCC regulations, they will continue broadcasting. Meet Free Radio Santa Cruz, folks. It is the people who are campaigning for a low-watt license class that must assess their degree of solidarity with the movement's other factions and come to an agreement on what they will accept from the FCC. Then they must turn their attention to pressuring the FCC for nothing less. The FCC, if it approves anything, may compromise between pressure from the National Association of Broadcasters, out to protect their market dominance, the belief that high-power stations reach the most people and therefore serve the public interest without qualification, and microbroadcasters' demands, and establish a 1 watt license, 9 watts less than the one they abolished in 1978, and far less than most microbroadcasters' power. "That's why," says Pete Tradish, "we need to build a movement that is strong enough to reject with solidarity a bad offer from the FCC and continue to defy the law until we get a fair settlement." That's, again, microbroadcasting by Kate Duncan in the July-August 1998 issue of Z. That's like the letter Z magazine. You can read it in the Santa Cruz Main Library. I believe they get it there. If they don't, then wander on into the bookshop Santa Cruz, read it, and then leave. I can't do that because unless I put it in a disguise, Neil Coonerty will have me arrested, but that's another story. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, as you probably know. We're talking about microbroadcasting, pirate radio, low wattage radio, whatever you want to call it, radio that you can actually use as a community member, as distinguished from radio you have to pay tens of thousands of dollars to get on, or possibly get a one-minute public service announcement once a year if you're lucky. And that's really important, and that's why I'm here. Though I've got to note that I'm going to be trying something, I hope, if I can get my doo-doo together, as we say. I'm never sure how many people view this station, or I should say listen to this station, or in your mind's eye perhaps you view it. And I'm always concerned that a lot of this is going out to a few people who, and I want to thank you, listen to my show and like it, but that mainly what I'm saying hears on, it lands on the ears of the faithful. And that kind of means that the message isn't getting out to folks who haven't heard this before, or even people who have different ideas or hostile ideas to what I'm saying. I think it's important that we really reach you folks out there if you're listening. And one way to do that is to revivify, to resuscitate, to bring back the written word. And I turn out things called, well, they're flyers mainly. They're put out by HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. You can pick them up often at city council meetings where I show up. I give out speeches, and then I give out written versions of those speeches about events, usually having to do with civil rights of homeless people. And that's good. But what I used to do last year and for a decade before that was put out a publication that I called the Street Shit Sheet, which is essentially a newsletter dealing with homeless issues and police abuse. And sometimes in a very comic way, always in a very local and topical way, which talked a lot about our local personalities, be they Riot Act Ratkin on the city council, or Vicious Vinny here at the Micro Broadcasting Studio, who's still with us and patiently waiting until I finish this tirade. He, as I was saying before, no doubt he'll be a part of this next issue of the Street Shit Sheet if I can get it out. I'll be describing, passing on information that he's given us, and trying to put it out in a written form so that what I'm saying on the air gets wider circulation and more permanent circulation. That's one value of the written word. You can actually look at it later. You can consider it. It's also quicker to digest. I know I can read a lot quicker than listen to somebody on the radio, which can take forever. But let's get back to Vinny now. Vinny, you've come back from Philadelphia. You've been back a couple of weeks now.
Just a little over a week, yeah.
And this hasn't given the police much time to adjust to your return. Now, you, as the man who cracked the Happy John Dine case, I know you're a big favorite among some of the police officers. Anything interesting happened to you since you've been back?
Yeah, actually, I haven't officially been cited for any offense yet, but I'm sure someday, soon I will. I'm trying to keep my nose clean, of course, because I am on probation until the end of December.
Probation for?
Well, actually, that stems from a protest which happened on 120 Campbell Street, the former home of this radio station, back in August, actually almost 2 years ago. August the 19th, 1996, when 120 Campbell Street was torn down in a very high-profile protest. Basically, we were kicked out. That's another story. I'm not going to get into that right now, but...
Well, actually, very briefly, the previous home of Free Radio Berkeley was Santa Cruz, sorry. I like to think of us as Berkeley sometimes. Free Radio Santa Cruz was... earthquake damaged, and even though tenants were paying, the landlords did not keep up repairs, and the Moors, who ran the property, eventually attempted to, rather than repair the property as they were obligated to do, they tried to evict all the tenants, wouldn't give them relocation fees, and then attempted to essentially unlawfully evict them. Later on, the tenants received compensation money through the judicial order of Judge Samuel Stevens. But in order to dramatize their need to get this, as well as the fact that low-income housing was being destroyed in the Lower Ocean area, as well as the fact that homelessness was being created and not dealt with in the city of Santa Cruz, they nonviolently stayed in their house on the roof as the bulldozers moved in a situation that was perversely and maliciously mischaracterized by everyone from Karen Clark of the Sentinel to Lee Kornstrom of the Mercury News, in which they actually reversed the roles, whereas what actually happened was police went, raided the area, abused and kind of dragged away these people who were simply trying to get relocation funding. They were prepared to leave once they got that. Isn't that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
They dragged them away, and that their case was shown to be true, months later in the courts, and something you wouldn't read in the Sentinel, and of course that Lee Kornstrom never bothered to cover in the Mercury News. And then instead the whole focus was on urine, and I guess urine was the big word, because what happened was when these folks had barricaded themselves in, they had, carefully, so as not to despoil the area, pissed into bottles. Now, the claim was that these bottles were being used as weapons, but in fact, was that the case? Were you preparing to bomb the police with piss?
Well, actually, to state the facts, is that one of the tenants who had lived in the house prior to this protest, who had moved out prior to this protest, used to urinate into bottles because he, pretty much was a lazy guy and didn't want to go down the stairs to the bathroom. And when he moved out, he just neglected to clean his room of the said urine bottles. So, yes, in the moment of decision to barricade ourselves in, some of these urine bottles were placed in the stairwell amongst other pieces of furniture, desks, beds, mattresses, stuff like that. And when the police attempted to make their way up the staircase through the barricades, well, apparently some of their crowbars may have inadvertently struck some of these urine bottles, and causing some of them to spill down the staircase and subsequently getting Sergeant Andy Crane's leg pretty much soaked in urine. And we were dragged out of that house, and that's another whole story, though.
It is a whole story, which I'm glad you've clarified here. But are you suggesting that this was not a booby-trapped stairway intentionally designed to create a dangerous barrier or a noxious barrier to the police?
No, in fact, our intent was just to slow down the whole process and to dramatize the fact that we were being denied our relocation money unjustly, and that the city was forcing us into the streets, into a hostile environment where you can't even set up bedding between the hours of 11:30 and 8 in the morning.
It's 11 and 8:30.
Oh, excuse me, 8:30. So for a whole 9-hour period, you can't sleep in Santa Cruz unless you're inside, in a dwelling, which we were being forced out of. And we had no money to move into another dwelling since our landlords neglected to pay us the relocation.
I remember I was there covering it as a kind of a radio broadcaster. My program's been on the air for, about 3 years now. And I recall Andy Crane, when he got up there, or was it Andy Crane? It was one of the officers. Andy Crane, I know, is the fellow who got... claimed to have gotten urine on his uniform, which of course is a capital offense. But it's certainly worse than in dragging families out of a house and leaving them on the streets in violation of the law. I mean, urine is a more nasty thing than that. We can agree on that one, I'm sure. But I also know that the police dropped how many bottles. 10 bottles of, were they glass or they were plastic bottles,
milk,
right?
Milk bottles, yeah.
They were plastic milk gallons of urine from the roof onto the sidewalk, splattering them all over. Now, I only saw this happen once, and I wasn't watching every minute. I think I saw two of them come down, actually, at that point. But I did see it was a police officer involved.
In fact, yes, it's all on video, Robert. And it was, in fact, badge number 158, Officer Dave LeFevre, who threw the said urine bottles off the roof.
Well, there we have it. Officer LeFevre obviously doing a public service, trying to, fertilize the soil or perhaps the sidewalk below and provide Karen Clark and Lee Kornstrom with a little opportunity for some of their gutter journalism, which apparently he did. In any case... you're right. We got completely lost in the story. Now, the topic. What was the topic? The topic was how Santa Cruz has changed,
yeah,
and how the free radio situation has changed. I guess I was also asking you to comment on that before we completely eliminate all our time here on the show. And you say that, so. Sum it up briefly and take the mic out of my hands before I just
give me that mic. Damn it. Okay. So I've been back a little over a week now, probably about 11 days or so,
And it's really, I want to first say it's really good to be back in Santa Cruz. It's a beautiful place to live. There's a lot of interesting people in town. As always, people coming and going. It's a very transient type place, which I enjoy. I like the fact that people come and go. But unfortunately, yeah, the scene downtown has definitely dwindled to a very minimal standstill, really. And it just seems like there's a lot of shoppers out these days and not much street culture, which I'm kind of upset about because I enjoy going downtown and listening to the street musicians and seeing all the colorful people, which I don't see much of anymore. I see a lot of yuppie, preppy type people that all shop at the Gap, and it makes me sad because Santa Cruz is losing its originality, and very quickly, I might add, and that's all due to the recent construction boom, and it's all due to police crackdowns on the street culture downtown with ordinances like the sidewalk ordinance where you can't sit 10 feet from a building and 20 feet from a change machine or all these... 50 feet. See, I'm not exactly sure of the spatial limitations.
One of the reasons you may be a little confused is because you've just come back from Philadelphia, where I've been reading on the internet, you have your own, or they have their own anti-homeless laws that were recently passed. You want to tell us a little bit about Philadelphia's situation?
Sure. Yeah, there's quite a large segment of homeless people there. I don't know the numbers, but I'm sure it's in the tens of thousands. As it is a city of about 5 million residents.
Many black homeless?
Yes, many peoples of color, many Puerto Ricanos that are on the streets or squatting or living in squalor in poor neighborhoods that are being neglected. But they did just pass what they're calling the sidewalk control ordinance. And it actually is not in effect yet, but it will be going into effect in the first week of September. And in this ordinance, the law states that you can sit on the sidewalk for a 30-minute period, and then you will have to move on for 2 hours and be somewhere else and stay mobile, I guess, keep moving around. That's the main thrust of the law. But also, there's part of the law that says you cannot hand out handbills. It would make it against the law to pass on flyers to people. Which is limiting free speech and freedom of expression in Philadelphia, which is a really sad thing because, as we all know, that's where they drafted the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence also. So Philadelphia is basically, you know, the city that, you know, 200 years ago, our founding fathers came up with these ideas of freedom of expression and free speech and stuff. And that was one of their main ways of getting information around in those days was to, you know, handbills and street corner preachers, you know, ringing their bell, and they called them bards, I believe, in those days. And that's how people got information. And they're completely limiting that nowadays, and you just can't spread information to people, and it's a really sad thing. If you have an issue that you want brought to somebody's attention, what better way than to, you know, hand them a piece of paper with all the information on it, and that's being taken away.
Interesting. You may not know this, but the first draft of the downtown ordinances in Santa Cruz, under which we currently suffer, so to speak, which passed in 1994, contained a similar provision making it illegal to give out a political or religious handbill unless requested to do so by someone on the street. Now, why this would ever happen, why anyone would ever request it from you, It's clearly not just unconstitutional, but a ridiculous kind of ordinance. And I'm surprised, I'm astounded that Philadelphia would pass it. I have to look into this more, and hopefully I'll do an update on this, along with an update on Prescott, Arizona, which I'm hoping to play a tape from later in the show. This is an older tape. It's about interviews we did when we traveled through Arizona about a month and a half ago. Well, Vinny, I'm pleased to have you back. Is there more you want to say before I move into other areas?
Just a few closing words. It's really good to be back. Glad to be a part of this radio station again. And I just hope that people in Santa Cruz realize how special of a place this is. Actually, on my last show, I interviewed people on the street about why they think Santa Cruz is special. And I just wish people would realize that, you know, it is part of the the culture here to have, you know, dissenting viewpoints out on the streets and people playing music and a lively culture, which is quickly dwindling. So let's stand up for our rights and let's bring it back. And it's good to be back.
It's good to have you back, Vinny. Thank you for being on the show. And
thank you for having me.
Hey.
Vinny, you have your own show when?
It's actually 2 hours later than it used to be on Wednesdays at 11 p.m. till 2 in the morning. Actually, I'm going to try and get a better time slot during the day, but that'll, you know, just listen for me. I'll be in here a lot during the week, so I'm around again. So
you have a message for Vinny or a large check, you can leave a note on the voicemail at 427-4523. That's a free mail, free radio voicemail. And free radio voicemail will also take anything else you want to say for free radio. If, on the other hand, you have something more important to say and you want to talk to me, I'm at 423-HUFF, 423-4833. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3. Stay with us.
Don't you think that they're